What is the personal ordinariate, otherwise known as the Anglican ordinariate? What is its history? And what is its place in the church today? That's what we're going to talk about on today's Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage people to subscribe to our channel wherever you may listen to it or watch it. Like this video, like the podcast, give us a good review, whatever the case may be. That really helps other people to find out about it. Also, I just want to ask people to consider donating to Crisis Magazine. You can just go to www.crisismagazine.com/donate. We're completely donor supported, so anything you can do to help is appreciated. Of course, we appreciate even more your prayers for our apostolate. Well, I'm excited about today's podcast. I'll just be blunt. This one I've been looking forward to for a little while. We're going to be talking about, like I said, the personal ordinariate. I think some people know it as the Anglican ordinariate, the Anglican use. We're going to talk about all these different terms as well and what they all mean. Our guest today is Father David Palmer. He is a priest of the personal ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham, serving in the Diocese of Nottingham, Parish of St. Mary's with St. Paul's, and chaplain to the university students at Nottingham. Welcome to the program, Father.
Thank you for having me.
Let me tell us a little bit about your background. Are you a convert to Catholicism, or are you a married priest? All these different things I know are possibilities. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to be a priest of the personal ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham?
Okay, yes. Well, I'm indeed a convert to Catholicism. So I was a Church of England vicar, and then I'm married with kids. Although the kids are, the youngest is 19 now, so they're not really kids anymore, but. And then about 16 years ago, I became a Catholic. So that was before the Ordinariate had actually started. But I came to that position where I just knew this was what I needed to do, that this was the truth. So then when I became a Catholic, I spent the first sort of five, well, I did an MA in Catholic theology to try and upgrade my Anglican teaching, as it were. And then I spent sort of five and a bit years working as a lay Catholic chaplain in a prison in the UK. And then when I was working in the prison, I had a phone call from an Anglican vicar who was going to come through this ordinariate process and said, I think, you know, would you be interested? And so it kind of went from there, really.
Okay, so what year then were you ordained into the Catholic priesthood?
So I was ordained 2011.
Okay, and that was directly into the personal ordinariate at that time?
Into the personal ordinariate, yes.
Okay, so why don't we then take a step back then and tell us, what is the personal ordinariate? What are we talking about when we talk about the personal ordinariate? It sounds like an odd term, to be honest, I think, for most Catholics. So what exactly is it?
Okay, well, the actual phrase itself is personal ordinariate, which what it means is that it's not, so you can get a military ordinariate, for example, and so it's not geographically based. So it's not a diocese, you know, you have a geographic diocese with the diocesan bishop. So in an ordinariate, you're connected to your ordinary personally rather than geographically. Okay, so the personal ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham, and the other ordinariates as well. There's one, the Chair of St. Peter, and the Southern Cross, I think it's called, sort of America and Australia as well. So basically, Pope Benedict had been petitioned by groups, well, not even before him, but groups of Anglicans had been petitioning at Rome, saying that, you know, we would like to become Catholic, but we'd like to do it in a way that we can come as a group with our people as well, and maybe even keep some of this sort of what they call patrimony, which we can go into a bit more later, of the Anglican patrimony. And so Pope Benedict very generously issued an apostolic constitution, Anglicanorum Chaetibus. I think that was 2011. That was when it was officially erected, as it were, to allow that to happen, so that groups of Anglicans could petition the Holy See as a group and be received into the Catholic Church as a group. Now, I actually, that original, the original hope, I think, was that kind of whole, you know, parishes with their schools would kind of come across. And to an extent that happened more in America, but there's more of an issue in England because the churches don't belong to the the parish in the Church of England. So if groups leave, they lose their buildings. So not as much of that happens as I think was initially hoped. And I would even go as far as saying the Ordinariate has almost changed what I think its purpose is. But that was the initial idea.
Right, okay. So now just to make sure we're clear, so personal ordinary itself, the term, technically that could be applied in other situations in the future as well, right? It's nothing Anglican about the idea of personal ordinary. It's just like this is the canonical structure. Yeah. And so, and that's different than, I know there's like, you know, you mentioned the military ordinariate. So if you are a member of the military, if you're a priest, I should say, of the military ordinariate, that means you answer to the ordinary. And just for people who don't know, ordinary is the canonical term, usually just for a bishop. Yeah. The ordinary of a diocese is the bishop of the diocese. Yeah. So that's where the term ordinariate comes from, I assume. And so that's the case. But that, and that's different also then from a personal prelature, like Opus Dei. And I don't know exactly how it's different. I just know it is different from a personal prelature because that's what Opus Dei is. And I think Opus Dei, it's like the idea is they're still part of their normal parish, their diocesan parish. They're not part of some separate structure. So they still kind of answer to their bishop in a sense. Yeah. But then you have these priests as personal prelature, the Opus Dei priests, right? Does that sound right?
That's right. That sounds
okay.
About right.
Okay, perfect. And then the personal ordinary, the one we're talking about, there's three... I guess, ordinariates within the overall structure, right? There's the one that's for the UK. There's one for America. And that's the one you're in, which is Our Lady of Walsingham.
That's the UK one, yeah.
And then the Chair of St. Peter is the one for United States and Canada.
Yeah.
And then I forgot the name. Holy Cross, I think?
Yeah, I think it's the Holy Cross or the Southern Cross or something like
that. Right, and that's the one in Australia and maybe other areas over there as well. So, okay, so we have that defined then. Now, you mentioned that, so that's the history. So, and I remember when this happened, it was funny. I was just starting, this is a stupid aside, but I was just starting my personal blog. And that was the first thing I ever blogged about was Pope Benedict. And so I think it was 2010, 2011, something like that, setting us up. So the idea was that you have these parishes would come over completely. They just go from being Anglican to being Catholic, but now they're part of the personal ordinariate. But you say that didn't really happen in the UK, at least, and for some obviously legal reasons, it sounds like. Yeah. And the mission has kind of changed. How would you say then the mission has changed from maybe what the original vision of Pope Benedict and some of the first people who were involved in it? How has that changed?
Okay. Well, there were a couple of, you know, groups that came across that were big enough to carry on becoming, you know, a live community, as it were. But in most cases, it was more sort of... individual priests, individual lay people who kind of came across. And I would say, I think where the shift has gone is, well, what do we mean by patrimony? And I have to say, when I first joined the Ordinariate and became a priest, and I was using the same liturgy that every other Catholic priest used, and you sort of think, well, why am I in this? You know, then I ended up working in a diocesan parish, and then, you know, why am I in this ordinariate thing? And for a while, I was kind of considering possibly kind of excarnating and joining the diocese. But then the missal was released. And now we have the Ordinariate Divine Office book as well. And also all of confirmation and baptism and stuff. But when the missal was released, I kind of thought, actually, this is brilliant. I'm beginning to understand what they mean by Anglican patrimony. This is a liturgy that I love. And the office books just coming increase that as well. So I think what it's almost become now is almost like, so I have an ordinariate mass on Sunday evening at my parish. And most of the people that come to that aren't members of the ordinariate, but a good number of them are students, actually. And they come because there's something about the liturgy that resonates with them. And I think when we talk about patrimony, I think the way I understand this is that in England, a lot of, and you know, this is just for obvious historical reasons, but because of the Reformation, a lot of the kind of Catholics in England came, you know, to the Irish and the Polish and, you know, various waves of Catholics from other countries. And with them, they brought all their, you know, their devotions, their way of being Catholic, I suppose. And barring the kind of the recusants, if you like, most English people always had this sense that to become a Catholic is somehow to become something a bit foreign, if that makes sense, a bit alien to the English culture. And so what the Ordinariate does is very much focused on that kind of Catholic, the English Catholic tradition. So we have, you know, focuses on, you know, the kind of English saints, the those sort of traditions. The liturgy of the Ordinariate, the Mass, has a lot taken from the old Sarum, mm-hmm. right, which was the kind of, you know, the English Missal before, you know, before the Reformation and everything. So it's kind of reconnecting to the roots, the kind of the Catholic roots of this land. And so some of the kind of, you know, we kind of have great celebrations of Our Lady of Walsingham. John Henry Newman is our patron, of course, who was also a convert from Anglicanism to the Catholic Church. A lot of the old English saints that people have forgotten about are very much celebrated within the Ordinariate. So I think what it's done is given a way to be Catholic, but still feel, you know, authentically English,
Definitely. I personally, I have a great love of the English Catholic tradition. I've read, so much of the history. I'm reading a book right now, but Maisie Ward edited it, and I can't remember, The English Way of Life or something. It's about Catholic saints from England, and it's beautiful. Yeah. Now, I want to talk more about the liturgy in a minute.
Yeah.
But first, I just want to make sure, like when we published a crisis a few weeks ago, and our articles about the personal ordinariate, but I used the term Anglican use. In the title I gave it, not the author didn't necessarily. And I had a priest of the personal ordinariate contact me and say, that's not really the term.
Yeah.
And so I felt bad that we had used the wrong term. So I want to know, like, because there's personal use. A lot of people use the term Anglican ordinariate, and I've seen Anglican use, but Anglican use seems to be something different. And could you explain those different terms so we call things by the right terms?
Okay. So the Anglican use, this was specifically, I think, an American thing. So before the Ordinariate, there were various, there had been occasions where Anglicans had come over sort of en masse, so to speak, and they were given sort of permission for an Anglican use missal, which was much more like the kind of old Anglican service, but was kind of Catholic. But the divine worship missal, which is what we call it now, has sort of superseded that. So though in some senses, I mean, there are, I guess, elements that are similar, it's a different missal, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And then in terms of the Anglican Ordinariate, that's helpful in terms, I suppose, of giving some idea of where it comes from. But of course, a lot of us would say, well, we're not the Anglican Ordinariate because we're not Anglicans anymore. You know, it's the Ordinariate of Our Lady wasn't for former Anglicans.
Right, right. Yeah. You're Catholic, you're not Anglican.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, Pope Francis has actually broadened. So what you used to have to be a former Anglican to join, although you can go to Mass if you're not, you know, if you weren't, obviously the Mass is valid and everything. But now, if you're baptized as a Catholic, as a child, but complete your initiation through the Ordinariate, you can join the Ordinariate. So, I mean, if you're a Catholic and you marry someone with an Anglican background, you can join through being married. So I know an example of a family member, actually, who's Irish Catholic, born and bred. But he's joined the Ordinariate because he married someone that was an ex-Anglican. And now their child has been baptised in the Ordinariate. So as it kind of goes on...
Say join the Ordinariate, you mean be an actual official member of a parish that's an ordinary parish, correct?
Well, not even that. You can join without... So by joining the Ordinariate, you come under the... under the ordinary of the Ordinariate. So you could still go to a local parish church and not go to an ordinary church, but still be a member of the Ordinariate.
Okay. So the lay person, your ordinary, the person that you would kind of answer as a lay person would answer, it would be the Ordinariate ordinary, whoever that might be. Okay.
So if you were to get married, for example, the records would go to the Ordinariate rather than the diocese. Yeah.
Now, I know, like, I also thought I heard something about you didn't necessarily have to be a convert from Anglicanism. For example, I was a Methodist, and I converted to Catholicism, came into church. So would a Methodist convert, for example, be eligible? Because, of course, we are from, Methodists broke away from the Anglican church.
I think there are, There is generosity. Let's put it, right. put it that way. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, because I think I read that word like Methodists and maybe even Lutherans or something. I mean, I'm not sure why Lutherans, but you know, something. It probably sounds just like, you know, we're not going to be real sticklers for who can join type of thing. Yeah. So, now, so we talked a bit about the liturgy and the patrimony. Most of the people I would assume who are watching this, listening to it, either attend the Novus Ordo or the traditional Latin Mass. So explain to us, or maybe even, and I know some, we've had somebody on who talked about the Eastern Catholic liturgies, and so some might also attend the Eastern Catholic liturgies. So explain where the Ordinariate Mass, I assume that's the name for it, fits into that spectrum of the Novus Ordo, the traditional Latin Mass, and the Eastern Catholic liturgies. Where does it fit?
Okay. I think the first thing I would say is I think, this is my personal opinion, that the Ordinariate Mass is probably the Mass that the Council, Vatican II Council, envisioned rather than the one we got, if that makes sense. So, yes. So to put it, I mean, what it's most like, and I know some of my ordinary brethren would not like me saying this, but I think this is the easiest way to explain it. It's most like the best way of describing it is it's like the Latin Mass in Tudor English. Okay, so that's the kind of, so it tends to be ad orientem. There's prayers at the foot of the altar, silent offertory prayers, double genuflections. All those things are written into the Ordinariate rite. The calendar, although we keep the saints and everything of the Novus Ordo days, but we have seasons. So we have pre-Lent and all that sort of stuff as well. So if you're a cradle Catholic, you go to an Ordinariate Mass. What you will probably think is this is like the old Mass but in Tudor English.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, mention the calendar. So, for example, do you have Septuagesima season?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have that, but like, for example, the changes, how saints were moved. For example, this week when we're recording it, St. John Chrysostom on the new calendar, I think it's September 13th, and on the old calendar, it's January 27th. Which one would they do of that?
No, we do the new calendar is the calendar that we have to use for saints and things.
Okay,
and the readings would be the same. As the new lectionary, although we don't use the same well, I think the Americans would be different, but in England, the translation we use in the Ordinaris is the Revised Standard Version, which the rest of the Church in England doesn't use. They use the Jerusalem, I think, or something.
So do you have, like, in the new Mass, a first reading, Psalm, second reading, and then Gospel?
Yes, although the Psalm can be... the Psalm's optional, because we also have the thingy, what are they called, gradual...
Oh, right. Okay. You do. Okay.
Which is in the Missal.
Now, what do you do on a day like Septuagesima Sunday, for example, which would be the like fifth, let's say, Sunday of ordinary time, but it's Septuagesima Sunday, how would you do readings on that day? Like, how would that work? Because that seems to be, you wouldn't want the readings for the fifth Sunday of ordinary time.
Yeah. And I'm afraid that's what they have given us. So basically it's the same, but wearing purple.
Okay.
Rather than green.
And I guess you don't, and you wouldn't say the Alleluia, I assume.
Not the Alleluia, no, no.
Right, okay. Yeah. Okay, so it's got a little bit of both, but it sounds like it's much more leaning towards the traditional Latin Mass as far as the liturgy itself.
Even with the last gospel at the end as well. I mean, the whole structure, the structure would be very, very, very recognizable to anybody that goes to the Latin Mass. And to be honest, a lot of the students that come to my Mass on Sunday evening, once a month there's a Latin Mass they go to, but the other three Sundays it's not there, so they come to me. I think they see it as a kind of halfway gateway drug, maybe.
Gateway drug. Exactly, that's right. Now explain also, like, and I think I have this right, but I want to make sure everybody else understands it. So the Eastern Catholics, they have a different rite. And I know there's a big controversy right now. We'll talk about this in a little bit. In the Roman Rite, there's two. There's the form, the ordinary, what was called the ordinary form, and the extraordinary form, which Francis seems to be getting rid of. But let's not go down that path. But just the is the ordinariate then a rite or a form of the Roman rite?
It's a form. I think the official term is it's a use of the Roman rite.
Okay.
It's not a separate rite. But that does raise, not wanting to go too far down the line you just went there, but it does raise the issue when the document came out saying that the kind of the Novus Ordo, if you like, is the only the only form of the Roman rite. You think, well, that's not true. So we have the ordinary use, we have the Dominican rites. So actually, I don't understand how they can use that. My concern as an ordinary priest is, I know this is me being selfish, but they could use the same arguments to try and suppress the extraordinary form with the ordinary use, as far as I can see.
Right.
I hope they won't. But
I thought that too when I ran those articles a few weeks ago, Crisis, and I saw that it was actually, and somebody explained to me it's a separate form or use of the Roman rite. I'm like, well, hold on a second. They're saying the Novus Ordo is a unique expression. Yeah. With the implication it should be the only one. Yeah. So what happens to the ordinary? Let's not give them any ideas.
No. Yeah. I don't think they thought through it, so let's hope they don't. Yeah.
Right. And like you said, the Dominican rite, there's a parish in my town that it used to celebrate, is Dominican parish used to celebrate the Dominican rite. I mean, but it's all part of the Roman kind of Western tradition. Yeah. We're not really like the East as much. In the East has separate true rites separation, whereas we seem to have one kind of general rite that has lots of different uses and forms and things like that. Now, what is the role? Is there a role for the Book of Common Prayer in the liturgy of the ordinariate?
Well, this is our new book, which is our Divine Office book. And this, so somebody said it's like the Book of Common Prayer with bells on. So you have the basic morning and evening prayer in here. That's largely, so the Psalms are the same translation as the Book of Common Prayer. Most of the collects are the same because largely Cranmer just translated the collects from the Psalm rite anyway. But it has the additions of sort of antiphons for Magnificat and stuff. It has seasonal hymns. It has all the collects for other times that wouldn't have been in the Book of Common Prayer. But it does have the tradition of the extensive scripture reading as well. And so an ordinary priest is bound to say morning prayer and evening prayer or evensong alone, because morning prayer is basically office of readings and matins combined, and evensong is basically evening prayer and compline combined. So they're both quite chunky offices, but the idea was that you'd start your day, you'd say your morning prayers, then get on with your work, and then in the evening say your evening prayers. But this does also have prime, terse, sext, non, a separate compline as well, if you want to, but that's not considered to be canonically, you're not canonically obliged to. So.
Okay. And so that's basically, so the Book of Common Prayer is definitely influenced, it was, of course, influenced by the Roman rite, but it influences this, a divine office that now, and is this all three of the ordinaries use this book, or do you have different ones?
This is even more complicated. So this is called the Commonwealth tradition edition. Okay. So initially they were trying to get all three to have the same, but the tradition, the prayer book tradition in America kind of went on a slightly different path. So whereas Australia and England didn't. So in the end, we've got two editions. We've got I don't know what the American one's called, but this is the Commonwealth edition, Australia being its Commonwealth, current Commonwealth even. But so, yeah, but I haven't looked at the American one, so I don't know how different they are, but I wouldn't thought it'd be hugely different. But.
Are you familiar with I own this. I can see it right now. The old Anglican breviary.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, I have that, and it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful.
Wonderful. Now, how is that different than from what you're using now? This old, and for those who aren't familiar, it's from. I know it's pre 1955 because it has like even the old pre 1955, but it's very similar to, excuse me, to the Latin Divine Office from before 1955, yeah. but it's called the Anglican Breviary. And yeah. what is that compared to what right. you're using?
So the Anglican Breviary was basically, but I have a copy myself up there somewhere. So the Anglican Breviary was basically crafted, if you like, by a group of very sort of high church Anglo-Catholics who wanted the Roman Breviary in English,
okay.
largely. But they also did twiddle a few things. So I think they added Charles the Martyr, a feast for him, which of course no self-respecting Catholic would have. But yeah, so basically they would produce it, and it's a beautiful book, you know, with all the kind of the readings of the saints, and I mean, it's absolutely glorious. And then of course Rome changed it anyway, so it's a bit of a historical curiosity as well. But it is absolutely gorgeous. So the divine worship one, the breviary, more so than the mass, does draw more on the old prayer book tradition. So you have those two hinge offices of morning prayer and evening prayer. And I mean, the Bible is bound in here as well. And readings, you read through almost the entire Bible in the course of the year as part of your office. So there's a lengthy Old Testament and New Testament reading in the morning and in the evening, which is a very kind of Anglican tradition. But then the smaller offices are much more similar to the Anglican Breviary, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay. I'm getting a little bit into the weeds here, but I'm very fascinated by it, so I don't mind.
The language is great.
Now, I guess a question arises: why should there be like this special group set up for Anglican converts? You know, I'm a Methodist convert. There's Lutheran converts. There's Baptist converts. Why should the Anglicans be treated differently and given their own group? Why shouldn't they just be thrown into the whole general church, the general Novus Ordo and all of that? What makes it different?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of answers to that. I think the first answer is, I think Pope Benedict was actually hoping that this might even be a model for ecumenism. So, you know, we talk about ecumenism a lot and you know, we've got to work together, but actually it's all a bit pointless if the eventual aim isn't visible unity. And we're not going to get visible unity by all becoming Baptists or all becoming Methodists. That's just the only place that unity could happen is with Rome. So I think it was an attempt. So is there a way that we can actually say to our, you know, our ecumenical partners, and of course Anglicans is easiest to do with because in many ways a lot of the traditions in Anglicanism are less far away, if you like, than some of the other traditions. Is there a way we can say, look, you know, you can keep something, you know, of that in your tradition, which is good, but bring it into union with Rome? Yeah, I guess rather like, if you say the Eastern churches, rather like the Eastern churches that came back into union with Rome. So they kind of re-come back into communion with Rome, but are still allowed to keep something of their patrimony. So you'll get, you know, Ukrainian Catholics saying the Jesus prayer or icons, you know. So I think that's it, that's the kind of model. There was talk, I don't think anything came of it, of some sort of Lutheran ordinariate being set up as well, but I don't know if that's got anywhere.
And to be honest, it's, you know, obviously with the Eastern churches, they were fully Catholic in essence before they, in the sense of their liturgy, the sacraments, all that. So it was pretty easy then to bring them back and just say, okay, now you're in communion with Rome, but you can keep everything you had other than that. And then with the Anglicans, I mean, let's be honest, they definitely, there's at least a tradition within Anglicanism that is far closer to Catholicism than anything you'd find in Lutheranism and definitely like Baptist or anything like that. So it does seem to make sense, because although the Catholic Church did not recognize the orders of Anglicanism as valid, you still had a lot of the same structure, a lot of the same general, at least the high church. I'm not talking about the wacky Anglicans, but
and of course the high church is the background to this as well. I mean, so in some ways, hence John Henry Newman being our patron. So for those that don't know, of course, I mean, within the Church of England, particularly from the time of the Oxford Movement, there was a group who have longed for a union with Rome and the Anglo-Catholics. Now, a lot of those gave up and became Catholic, including John Henry Newman, but others kind of carried on. And that tradition carried on in the Church of England. always losing some people to the Catholic Church on the way. It's been a great way of converting Anglicans, actually. And at one time, there was this hope that, you know, I think at the time, Archbishop Ramsay and Pope Paul, whatever it was, who came to England, and it almost looked like there might be a possibility of corporate reunion. But that was kind of thrown under a bus, really, with the ordination of women, because once the Church of England's done that, you can't come to an agreement where we say, okay, you know, we'll take you and reordain all of you, because the situation's changed. Right. And I think for many Anglo-Catholics, that was the moment they realised that this was never going to happen. So they had to, you know, make the decision to go to Rome. And the ordinariate kind of came out of that, probably.
Right. And you may not know this since you're not Anglican anymore, but is there still, like, the high church movement within Anglicanism? I would think, of course, the ordination of women, which happened in the 70s, right?
The 80s,
okay. And then they started ordaining women as bishops as well at some point. That was later, I think. But I would think that would have really killed the high church Anglicanism. But is there still a relatively strong high church within Anglicanism?
It certainly isn't as strong as it was, because a good chunk of us, I suppose, have joined the Catholic Church. For example, the famous example would be the Shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham, which has an Anglican version as well as a Catholic version. And that was always the kind of great centre for Anglo-Catholics. Now, that still exists. It's still just about going on, the Anglican one. But you do get to a stage where you think, well, those who are still... I mean, it's very much weakened as a position, because it's not coherent anymore, if it ever was, but it definitely isn't now. And you do get to a stage where you think those who are still doing it are more interested in... I mean, I don't want to be too insulting, but more interested in dressing up and playing a role than actual the truth.
Right,
faith would be my take.
So there was a bishop that recently converted from Anglicanism back in September. And what was his name again?
Michael Nazir Ali.
So, and I think he was from the evangelical wing, not the high church wing. So was he brought, do you know him, and was he brought into the personal ordinariate?
Yeah, I do know him, because he actually ordained me as an Anglican many years ago. So I was there at his ordination as a Catholic priest. So I know him well. And I knew him well. I haven't had much contact in the last few years, but we have had a bit of contact since he's joined. And he's fascinating for the very reason you say, because unlike a lot of the other people that joined the Ordinariate, he didn't come from the Anglo-Catholic wing. Some of us started as evangelicals, but most of us, by the time we gone up the candle, as they say. But he was one of the leading evangelical bishops. He was a bishop of Rochester, the Anglican Diocese of Rochester. So that was quite a significant role, a bishopric in the House of Lords, I believe, when he was a bishop of Rochester. He was one of the contenders for the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was between him and Rowan Williams back in the day. They were the two names. And very much known to be an evangelical. And indeed, right up until him coming over, he was still kind of very involved with sort of evangelical groups and things. So his conversion is hopefully a sign of things to come, and that the Ordinariate may have a wider appeal than just, you know, the usual suspects.
Is he in the Ordinariate?
He's in the Ordinariate, yes. Okay. He was ordained. Remember, he's a priest of the Ordinariate now, yeah.
Okay.
And for him, so he became a Catholic because I think the big issue for him, as for many, was authority. You know, the church. How does the Church of England have the right to make these decisions? You know, what gives it the right to go to depart from historic Christianity? And so I think for him, the Catholic tradition or the Catholic Church has that authority in that sense. But the Ordinariate, because I think he likes the liturgy, to be honest, I think that's his main reason. He finds a sort of resonance and a beauty in it. But it's not the only one. There's another guy from a evangelical background, actually, who wasn't a diocesan bishop, but Dr. Gavin Ashenden. I don't know if you've
Yes, I'm familiar with him.
So he used to be a chaplain to the Queen, and then he kind of became bishop of a sort of breakaway Anglican group. So it wasn't to like a diocesan bishop or such. But he is, I don't know if I'm giving away... he's joining the Ordinariate. I think that's known now.
Yes.
If it's not, well, I'm sorry, Dr. Gavin. So I think for a similar reason. So initially he joined he became a diocesan Catholic, and now particularly with again the liturgy that he's kind of come on board as well. So, and he wasn't from a high church background. So you know we are beginning to see more people, and I suspect partly. The office books helped with that because the mass is very clearly, you know, very high church, Catholic, you know, whereas this has enough of the kind of middle of the road Anglican sort of scriptural basis to be perhaps less threatening, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, no, that does. Yeah. Now, is he ordained a Catholic priest?
Not yet.
Not yet.
But I think that's in the pipeline.
Yeah. Okay. So, and he was a bishop as well. So that's amazing. And just for everybody's listening to be clear, the bishops in the Anglican Church are typically married, which is why in general, you can't have in the Catholic Roman tradition, and actually what am I talking about? All traditions, Christian traditions, you can't have married bishops. Yeah. And so that's why they wouldn't become, they would never become bishops, these bishops.
And that's why, so for example, the ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham, was also an Anglican bishop and married, so he is not a bishop. He has juridic status, so we still kind of make promises to him, but he has to bring a diocesan bishop in to if anyone gets ordained or, you know, to bless the oil of chrism. He can't do that because he doesn't have the sacramental authority to do that. Whereas in America, the ordinary in America is a bishop, but he was already a Catholic priest and not married.
Right. So. Okay. And that's Lopes, right? Isn't that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now I wanted to ask, like, how would you say the day-to-day spirituality, you talked about it a little bit, but the difference in spirituality, just day-to-day in the prayers, in the maybe the saints and all of that, would you say that would differ from maybe what a typical person who attends the Novus Ordo or even a traditional Latin Mass, how is it different for somebody who is a member, like a full, not just somebody who just goes every once a month because the Latin Mass isn't available, but really is part of the ordinary? How does their spirituality differ?
Yeah, I think if you're actually, if you're using the office book, that's the kind of clearest way because it actually saturates you in scripture, which was all very, very much, that is one of the strengths of Anglicanism, actually, you know. So it's very scripturally rich. The language is a sort of sacral English, which isn't common in, you know, in a Novus Ordo Mass, you know. But sometimes, I mean, the new Missal's a better translation than the old one, but even so, sometimes it feels a bit like kind of committee English, whereas this is kind of very, you know, poetic and beautiful English. And because it's the kind of language that we don't talk in normally, this might sound a bit counterintuitive, but we don't normally speak this English. So when we go into Mass or into our morning prayer using this language, it kind of takes you into different space almost, if that makes sense, sort of sacred. Right. But the language itself has cadences that seem elevated, which is only correct if you're coming into the presence of God, that we use our most elevated, most, you know, our finest language. So that kind of feel is different. I suppose there's also a sort of sense of, so for example, this isn't actually an ordinariate organisation, but quite a few of us are in it. It's called the Society of St. Justin Martyr. And what they do is they encourage their members every time they see, and in England there's lots of these, when you see a church that used to be a Catholic place of worship, but now no longer is, and so most of the old beautiful Anglican cathedrals, Anglican churches would have been built for Catholics, by Catholics. And so Society of St. Justin, they go into these places, they pray for the souls of the Catholics who worship there, Catholics who built there, and pray for the conversion of those who currently worship there. So there's that kind of rooted sense of that this nation was Catholic, right. And that we're actually trying to hold on to the ancient faith of this country. And I think we're more conscious of that, more aware of that, partly even from being Anglicans. If you go to Canterbury Cathedral, it's most bizarre. They have a list of all the archbishops of Canterbury, starting with Augustine, right the way down, and it carries on without any mention of the Reformation down to the current one, as if there's been an unbroken chain. And that's the kind of thing that sold to most people in England, if you know what I mean. You know, in your history, you talk about Michael Nazarelli, the Bishop of Rochester. You go into, when you go to his house, Bishop's house in Rochester, there'd be a big painting of John Fisher, as if there'd been no kind of discontinuity at all. You know, I'm not sure he would no longer argue that, but by the way. But, and I think it's that kind of awareness that actually, no, there's a kind of cuckoo in the nest in our country. And it's having that awareness and praying, you know, that deep desire for praying for reunion with the universal church. And if that kind of gives a sense.
Definitely. I think it's really beautiful because, like we were talking about, in the East, you have a lot of different traditions. You have the Melkites, Ukrainians, and we might on the West make them think they're all the same, but they really do have very distinct differences in their spirituality and even in their liturgy and things. And here in the West, we tend to just lump everybody together, no matter who you know, if they're Polish or if they're German or whatever. But this is like saying that the English, you know, at least for that, is a specific thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was going
to. Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. But yeah, so the English, you know, allowing the English to be English, to not distance themselves from their heritage. As you said, it's a very Catholic heritage that was lost in a lot of ways, of course, in the 16th century. Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to, you mentioned that I think is a huge controversy among Catholics, but it sounds like the personal ordinariate is going a whole different direction, and that's the issue of language and the liturgy, because usually it's seen as there's two options in the West, the Latin or the vernacular, which is basically the language of the common man as spoken in normal. And I know one of the biggest arguments for the Latin in the liturgy is that it's precisely a sacred language, and it's not a common language that you just, like, you're talking to your friend at the bar or something.
Yeah.
But yet you're giving a third option, which is, it is vernacular. I mean, you would English speakers would understand it, yet it's not what you speak at the bar or wherever you might go. Yeah. And so I think that's an interesting thing that I think that in the West, because I do think that's also similar to the East, because I'm pretty sure a lot of their liturgies, they're in the vernacular, but often they're an old, like, Church Slavonic or something like that, which isn't really, it's kind of understandable. But not really. Does that make sense? Is that kind of what we're talking about here?
That makes total sense. And I think that's exactly what it is offering. And I think that's why we get kind of quite a few of these young Latin Mass types who take refuge to an extent at the Ordinario Mass. And partly some of them are also my students at the university. So that helps as well. But you know, people do want beauty. And I think, I mean, to get a bit controversial for a second, if you think about the kind of the history of the art in the Catholic Church, the beauty, the gorgeous art, and then for this synod thing, we come up with what looks like a play school.
Right, it's Sesame Street.
And you kind of think, but people do want beauty, people do want transcendence, people do want to feel taken out of their, you know, their normal. I mean, there was an Anglo-Catholic tradition. A lot of the great Anglo-Catholic churches, the ones that worked back in the day, were built in kind of slum areas in England, but they were absolutely ornate and beautiful. And the whole idea was, when people step into here, they get a sense of heaven, of transcendence, or something that's beyond their everyday experience. And the ordinary liturgy is certainly trying to keep that, you know, there's a great sense of reverence, beauty. That's very much the the focus of it.
Right.
And so I think, yeah, so I mean, you know, in many ways, when they used to talk about the reform of the reform, which is a bit out of date at the moment, but things might change. This is kind of this. I would always imagine this is the kind of fruit that somebody like Pope Benedict would have seen as the synthesis, in a way.
You talk about the church buildings. Are most ordinary parishes, do they have their own, or are they sharing? Are they using a diocesan parish?
At the stage, most are sharing. So, you know, in lots of cases, the ordinariate priest is not actually running the church even. He might be visiting. In some cases, the ordinariate priest is the priest of the church, but he'll have to also do the Novus Ordo masses, if you like, as well as the ordinariate mass. That's probably the most common. There are one or two places where they've actually, you know, completely set up their own churches, but the vast majority, there's some sort of, but I don't think that's altogether bad. In that, because I've got a parish, and then Sunday morning, you know, I say my Novus Ordo mass, and people come along. Sunday evening, I have the ordinariate mass. What happens after time is that people from the Novus Ordo masses get to know you. They know you're not going to wreck everything from their viewpoint. You know that you're going to let them have the mass they want, and then they actually start being more open to the other one. So I get quite a lot of people now that will come to the ordinariate mass as well, or will alternate. So one of the things about Anglicanorum Chaetibus was also about sort of sharing the riches both ways. So, and I think in that sense, by having it a bit more permeable, perhaps, there's a sense that the hope is, for me, that some of the riches, certainly in terms of reverence and all that sort of stuff, might actually seep beyond the ordinary mass into the wider. I've got several priests in the diocese so a priest can say an ordinary mass who isn't in the ordinariate if they're either covering for a regular one or it's a particular, you know, ordinary event. I have several priests in the diocese now who are diocesan priests who now have learned how to say the ordinary mass because they enjoy it. So every time, you know, if I can't make a particular Sunday, I've got a whole group of them who will be very happily come running over to say the ordinary mass. You know,
it's a very Pope Benedict. You can tell it was created by Pope Benedict because that's exactly what he was also intending with the Summorum Pontificum as well, was this idea of some sharing so that the good things bleed into the other. So that seems to be, I'm glad to hear it's working, at least in some cases where you are. And so what is we're going to finish up here, but a couple last questions. First is, what is the kind of the status of ordinary right now worldwide? Is it growing? Is it is it becoming more popular, or is it just kind of staying the same? Is it shrinking? What is the status?
It is growing. But it's growing slowly, if I think that's the best way of putting it. It is growing, and certainly more people are coming to the masses, but of course it's actually quite hard to actually officially join. So I can say it's my own mass. When I started, I had about only 10 people turning up, whereas now we regularly get, I don't know, 60 at the ordinary mass.
Wow, okay.
But a lot of those people couldn't join in if they wanted to. Okay. So I had a Polish altar server who wanted to join, actually asked if he could join, but there was no way that we could get around the... So there were several things like friends...
You have a hard cap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, just... he'd have to. But in some ways, but even that, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because in some ways, as long as it is growing, which it is, it can actually root itself perhaps a bit better. You know, if you get kind of huge influx and it's all like, you know... So it's actually kind of developing, and you know, we've got in England a couple of young men preparing for ordination, and we regularly have more ordinations than the average diocese does. So in England, that's not saying much, but
That's great though. That's good to hear. And where can people find out? So if somebody wants to really learn more about the personal ordinary, maybe find out where one. I mean, ordinary mass is near them. How would they find out? I know it's going to depend on whether or not they're in the UK or in America or Australia, but what's the best way to find that out?
If you're in the UK, there's a couple of publications that are produced. One is called The Portal Magazine, which you, as well as on paper, you can find it online, which is kind of the official Ordinariate magazine that has a listing of all the Ordinariate masses in the UK. There's another magazine produced by Friends of the Ordinariate, which is actually, a better magazine, I think, in terms of, well, it's got a different purpose, but in terms of the kind of the history and the theology, it's more in depth in those sort of things. The Portal's more, you know, easy read. I don't know. I'm guessing the easiest way to do it if you're in the States or Australia is probably simply to Google the Ordinariate and see what comes up. I'm sure they'll have.
I'll try to find a couple of links and put them in the show notes so people can, for each of the different or three Ordinariates. That's great. And where? And I know you're on Twitter. Where can people find out about you?
Well, Twitter's probably as easy. Well, do I want to encourage people to follow me on Twitter? I'm not sure.
I kind of would hesitate before I asked you. You might not want them to.
Yeah, but on Twitter I am. What am I? On Twitter I am at Father David Palmer. So that's quite straightforward. Okay.
I'll link to that as well and send all the hordes to you.
I do occasionally get in trouble on Twitter. Just as a warning, if you're going to follow me. So,
We all do. It's okay. Eventually, we'll all get kicked off, but that's okay. Well, Father, I really do. This is great. I tried to tell myself, okay, don't let this go 5 hours. Not everybody might be as fascinated as I am, but you know, I think this was great. Gave a good overview. People can understand. I also linked to the in the show notes. I'm going to link to the crisis articles that we had a couple weeks ago, so people can find out more. I just encourage people, if there is an Ordinariate mass near you, I think, you know, find a Sunday. My family, we have one. The closest one to us is an hour and a half away. But my family's already said we're going to make the trek one Sunday, maybe when the weather gets a little better, and attend one, because we've never been to one. But I think I'd encourage everybody to try to find one around you and go to it and just to experience, if nothing else. So, and thank you again, Father. And until next time, everybody, God love you.